You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley.
No, hang on, let me start that again. Sorry, this is what happens when I try to record too early in the morning. I can't form my thoughts very well. Oh, God, I've just completely lost it. What was I going to say? It's the 22nd of February, 2017. I'm Benjamin Riley.
And I'm Simon Copland.
Welcome to Queers. Each episode, we talk our way through questions on a theme, and this week we're talking about the politics of the gay gene. Before we get started on the main discussion, I wanted to talk briefly about an email that we received, because we now have our fancy new email address, which, to remind people, is, what is it? queerspodcast@gmail.com. God, you want to get that right? Simon's laughing at me. And fair enough, too. And so people, you know, feel free to send things to us. We love to hear from people. We've heard from people already, which is really lovely, from listeners. So send us in your questions and, you know, comments, feedback, stories, poems, artwork, anything you like, really.
Yes, please send in whatever you can. You know, we were just saying before, maybe a video of an interpretive dance.
Yes, and maybe... That's probably going a bit far, but, you know, whatever you feel comfortable doing. Maybe not whatever you feel, you know what we're trying to say. So we got an email from a listener regarding the last episode we did on respectability politics. And the listener sort of got the sense that we were suggesting through our discussion of the video that if you weren't kind of wholeheartedly enjoying and embracing what the video was saying and even watching the video itself, then you were homophobic or perpetuating some sort of the kind of homophobia we were talking about. And I guess, you know, Simon and I very much wanted I think we tried to say this in the discussion, but it's a good thing to emphasize, yeah, that we would in no way ever want to say that. You know, I think I am often quite frustrated by discourses within some parts of, sexual politics that kind of say if you are uncomfortable with anything, then you're a prude or there's something wrong with you. And I think that's kind of awful. And I would certainly have much more of a sort of live and let live attitude to these things. So being discomforted by something like the content of the House of Air video is totally, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, there were parts of it that I felt uncomfortable about. And so that's fine. I think where I would say, and Simon, I imagine you would agree with me, that sort of response crosses a line is when it becomes about policing other people's enjoyment of it or engagement with it, and policing what... you know, who we can say that represents and that sort of thing. So when it kind of goes beyond your own personal response. And so I just, we want to make it clear that we would never want to imply that discomfort puts you in the same category as people who are doing those sorts of things.
Yes, I 100% agree and don't really have anything else to add.
Sure. Okay, well, we can probably leave it at that. But it was a fantastic email and... yeah, it was really encouraging to hear people engaging with it in that way. So we hope we get some more of those.
Yes, please send some more things to us. We'd love to hear from you.
Dude, we're very lonely. No, I'm joking. We're fine.
Oh, so sad.
So let's get into it, I guess.
Yeah, well, this week's episode comes from a story from a few weeks back that also sparked our interest. In the start of February, the UK Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who, for the record, has a very long history of supporting LGBT rights and queer people, was heavily criticised when, during a speech to the launch of the LGBT History Month, he referred to people who chose to be gay. Corbyn was chastised severely for the slip of the tongue, with many using it to ask questions about whether he genuinely supported queer people.
This got Simon and I thinking about the importance of the born this way narrative. The idea that being queer is a genetic trait has become an essential rallying cry for many queer people. Through stating that people should not be denied rights due to biological traits, the born this way narrative has become central to campaigns for issues such as marriage equality.
But the attack on Corbyn has gotten us thinking about the implications of this discourse. Ben and I both wanted to ask why it is that this narrative is so important that we'll even attack such a clear ally as Jeremy Corbyn when he slips up on the issue. So, Ben, let's just start with that question. Why is it that you think that the Born This Way narrative has become so prominent within much of queer politics?
I think, I guess one of the reasons I think that this is an interesting topic is that I would argue that the prominence, the increasing prominence of the Born This Way narrative is sort of the culmination of a bunch of different things that you and I talk about. So it's sort of, it's a fundamentally essentialist idea, which obviously ties very much into the way that we talk about identity politics. So I think the rise of identity politics as this discourse that locates something like sexuality as a sort of inherent and immutable part of a person really lends itself to an idea like, you know, being born gay. So I think that's, part of it. I think it also sort of is fed into by respectability politics, which is something that we addressed really directly last week, but kind of touch on a bit often as well, which is, you know, the idea of sameness, the idea that we are sort of fundamentally just like everyone else except for this one particular difference, and should be treated as such. And if that difference is kind of biological and measurable and identifiable, then, you know, that's sort of scientific proof that it... I mean, it's funny, though, because it's sort of... It's almost like scientific proof of difference, but I guess it, like, you know...
Yeah, but it's difference-based in just, like, a slight biological difference. You know, it's just a tiny difference. It's not that... It's not, like, a whole lifestyle difference.
Totally.
It's just this one little genetic trait that, you know, that makes us slightly different, but it's kind of like... You know, everybody has, you know, one gene that makes you straight or gay. So we're just, you know, kind of the same, but just a little bit, you know, a little bit of a variation.
Totally. And I guess it kind of importantly dislocates being gay from culture. So I think that, like, those are sort of two big things that feed into this idea. It's also become, I mean, on a more, I guess, political level, it's also become a convenient, you know, as kind of, fights for kind of rights-based political fights among queer people have become more and more prominent and more high profile. It's become a really sort of convenient way to argue against attacks from particularly kind of religious conservatives saying that this is a choice and using that as a basis to argue for all sorts of things. I mean, like most kind of opposition to queer rights, I would say, in the past at least, has and still presently to some degree has rested on that idea of it being a choice or being a lifestyle, and so it's seen as a kind of way to argue against that. So I suppose those are what I would say are the things that primarily feed into this.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I think there's, like, you can see almost sort of two parts to this. So I think the first is the official reason why so many people like to talk about the Born This Way narrative, or why it's so important in queer politics, and not necessarily. I think there's a distinction between how we use this term, this idea, politically compared to the personal connection people have to it, and I'd like to talk about the personal connection soon. But the, you know, that's the narrative, the political value of the narrative is seen as a way to counteract attacks on queer people by, you know, particularly attacks that say, you know, it's a choice and therefore blah, 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 therefore we can, you know, it's a bad choice and, you know, it's this evil choice. And some people are trying to counteract that by saying, well, no, it's not a choice. You know, it's biological, it's inherent. And you shouldn't deny rights based on biological traits. Now, I would argue that that's a pretty poor political defense. And, you know, if you look at things like racism and sexism, it's pretty clear that people don't just stop denying, you know, stop discrimination because of biological traits. That happens quite often, and I don't think it actually works as a political defense, but it's clear that that's what it is. But I think that what I'm increasingly saying is what you're talking about is that there's also this underlying element to it that is about things like respectability politics. It's about using this term as a way to deny difference and to create sameness. And it's about identity, a whole range of identity politics, about essentializing our identity so that this is sort of, it reinforces the idea that your sexuality is core to your being, and therefore reinforces all of these ideas of identity politics that we've discussed in the past. And I think that that's the interesting dynamic that we've got here, is that you have this sort of official reason why we've got this narrative, and that's to counteract, I think, against these against queer attacks on queer people. But it also reinforces all of this conservative nature of a lot of queer identity politics that I think is really insidious. And I think that that's why I find it, I can't stand this narrative so much, is it because it does do those things of denying difference and taking away that space for difference. And I think your point on culture is really, really important as well, is that it can be used as a way of attacking queer culture or attacking queer lifestyle, which is something that we refuse to defend now. When someone says, well, it's a lifestyle choice, well, actually there are parts of it that are a lifestyle choice. There are parts of, we talked about this last week, the last episode, the idea of, the sexual practices that Brendan used is a lifestyle choice, but we can't, we refuse to defend that now. We refuse to be able to defend that. And the Born This Way narrative is a key part of that refusal.
Totally. And I feel like those sort of two types of, I guess, reasons that we're identifying for like why it's become prominent also sort of point to me, at least, to two kind of quite clear reasons why I have a problem with identity politics. As you said, the first being that it kind of lines up with the official line of like it's used to defend against attacks. The side effect of that obviously being that it does deny difference and really kind of doesn't allow us to fold people who don't look like us or don't act the way that, sort of quote unquote respectable queers do into that narrative, because there's no reason why they sort of have to do that if it's biological. And I guess the other reason, which ties more into the sort of the cultural stuff, is that it reinforces things like identity politics and really does kind of feed into that. And that's something that you and I have been very critical of.
Yeah, and I think there's a third thing that I don't like, which I'd like to add into this. And this is something that's sort of an idea that's forming in my mind, is that I think that the Born This Way narrative also, it sort of reinforces a minority position for queer people as a minority group. It reinforces that position, and so what you've got is a situation in which what's essentially occurring is, you say that there's two genes, there's the gay gene and the straight gene. The straight gene, 90% of people have that, and 10% of people have the gay gene, and you're born into one of those genes, and you cannot, according to this narrative, therefore cross over into these genes, and there is no such thing as sexual fluidity. There's no such thing as being able to change your sexuality or being able to move or have variations in your sexuality. You are just one or the other. And so what you see is great attacks on people who dare to question, who dare to say that, hey, actually, maybe I chose something around my sexuality. And that the classic example of that is Cynthia Nixon, who a number of years ago, it's like she's the example that I bring up all the time, said in an interview that she said something like, I've been straight and I've been gay, and gay is better. And people don't get to define my sexuality for me. I chose to be gay. And she received savage attacks for doing so. The idea that she could, from gay people, the idea that she could move from one to the other and make an active choice to do so and be happy with that choice, and she was savaged for it. And what it does is it reinforces this minority status amongst queer people and refuses to allow us to suggest, actually, do you know what, you can be queer, or you can have queer sex, or you can enjoy that, and you can also have straight sex and enjoy that. And you can do these things, and that is something that is available to everyone to do if that's what you want to do. And it's that's really bad for me. I don't like the idea that we sort of suddenly here we've just got now two boxes that you can fit into.
Totally.
You know, and it's all biologically determined. You have no choice in any part of your sexuality. You're just sort of stuck like this. That also builds into some potentially really negative stuff where you go, well, okay, well, it's, you know, if you look, if we've spoken about this in the past, where it's like, well, you know, my sexuality is just a biological trait, and therefore all my other preferences are exactly like that. So there's no reason for me to question why I've got, you know, when I say things like no Asians on my Gaydar, on my Grindr profile, that's just a preference. It's just what I've got. It's just what I'm like. You know, it's not like actually any questioning behind where do our sexual preferences come from? Where do our desires come from? All that kind of stuff.
Can we imagine a future where scientists are identifying the no Asians gene?
I can see people making that argument.
Sure. I know it's like the kind of ultimate reduction of the experience of sexuality. This also highlights to me that, you know, this is in large part an attack on kind of non-binary and fluidity around sexuality and gender, and, you know, also highlights why respectability politics and certain kinds of gay people, and even I would say, despite the significant political marginalization and social marginalization that they still face, even increasingly some trans people who look a certain way or are able to kind of come across a certain way, have been quite easily folded into mainstream political discourse, is essentially that goal of respectability politics to say that we're just like you. You know, the people who are left out of that and the people who are left out of, as you're saying, the born this way narrative are people who can't be categorized.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to think about it as a way of leaving out the non-binary folk, both in terms of gender and in terms of sexuality. In that,
and even just in terms of like presentation, I mean, I feel like gender becomes such a strange way to talk about this stuff, because like identity is sort of hovering there afterwards, often whether we say it or not. You know, we talk about sexuality and gender identity, but you know, like I'm someone who absolutely, you know, is a cisgendered man, but I think that I, you know, certainly present in not entirely traditionally masculine ways. Certainly not to the extent that people who face a lot more marginalization than I do. But it, you know, these, even our ways of talking about this stuff exclude people who don't fit into some very rigid categories.
Yeah, I think maybe this is where I could lead into. I'm also really interested in one thing that I've discovered when talking about this issue has been the way in which people really personally identify with the narrative. Mm-hmm. And really, the thing that I always come up against when I discuss this is people going, well, you know, this is very strongly my narrative. This is definitely, I was definitely born this way, and you can't tell me what I wasn't. And that's totally understandable, because obviously it's a big part of people's personal experiences. And you know, and I don't, you know, I hope that, I don't want to criticize that, you know, people's personal experiences of their own sexuality or gender identity. And, you know, I can definitely say that I, you know, for example, whilst I question it now, have, you know, previously had that sort of feeling that this is just sort of inherent to my being, and I'm sort of, you know, doing some questioning.
What do people say to you when they say that they identify personally with born this way?
Well, I just, you just get a lot of like, when I've written about this in the past, well, I just get a lot of like, no, this can't be right because I was born this way. You know, that's just, you know, it's just wrong. You know, I've been like this ever since I was, you know, ever since I was five, or ever, you know, I knew that I was gay when I was six, okay, that kind of stuff. And if have you ever seen the Born This Way blog?
No.
Oh, okay. You're going to have to go and have a look at it. It's just bornthiswayblog.com. But basically it's a user submitted blog. Where people submit photos of themselves when they were young, showing, you know, there's photos of the, you know, people who are like, you know, their five-year-old boy who's in a really camp pose or wearing girls' clothes, showing clearly I was born this way. Look at me. Totally. When I was.
I find that so fascinating, and I think this is kind of what we're gonna get into. But I also find it on some level really kind of sad, you know, that like even with a fucking five-year-old like presenting, like we are so uncomfortable with difference. That the only way we can handle a five-year-old being camp is to go, you were always gay?
Yeah, like, and that so there's something
deeply
there's something,
upsetting to me.
Like, so there's something, and that person, you know, there was clearly a gene that made you act like that.
Totally. Like, it just is so erasing of the vast difference of human diversity, of human experience, like to kind of assign it to, like, even without the born this way stuff, you know, even if we don't talk about it in terms of like explicitly a gay gene, but to just to reduce it so directly to like to even to sexuality, you know, just is it just makes me sad for like like little kids who are different or do want to be different, and you know that we can only handle that by categorizing them.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess what I was thinking about is with people in the queer community who really identify with this, I wonder, is part of the narrative, and I don't want to reinforce it, part of the narrative, is the Born This Way narrative used as a way to allow people to accept their gender, you know, a gender identity or sexuality that in fact we're all still deeply uncomfortable with, and this is the way that we have found an ability to accept it, to be able to live with it, you know.
Sure,
to say,
it's like, look, I don't hate myself for being gay because I had no choice.
Yeah, exactly, and that you know, and that's something that I'm increasingly seeing as like, you know, and it seems like in our last episodes, our last few episodes, every time we come back to internalized homophobia.
I know.
You know, and we discussed, I think it might be worth us doing an episode on internalized homophobia, because we had that discussion about whether it's actually internalized or externalized or not. I'd love to do that at some point.
Sure, sure.
But for me, this is a really good, another good example of a sense of internalized homophobia where we have to, we're desperate to find an excuse for our sexuality and our gender identity, you know, or for the difference that we have. We're so desperate to find it that we place a biological label on it as a way to say, this is, you know, this is the only way I can accept it. And the best examples of this are the people who I see, and this is something you see time and time again when people argue that, you know, this could, you know, that sexuality could be a choice or that it is a choice. You know, you see the people who say, you know, I wouldn't, you know, this clearly wasn't a choice. Who would choose to live to be gay? And that is a reflection on discrimination and the existence of oppression and feelings that people have that the hard lives that people go through and who would choose to live that hard life. And that's the, you know, and I understand that, but I think that also part of it is also just a genuine expression of like, who would choose to be different like this? Who would choose to live in this world in a different way?
I mean, what you're talking about fundamentally is shame, you know, like I feel like it's not just about direct experiences of discrimination and marginalization, as in like people sort of imposing that stuff on you. It's the feeling of being different, being shameful, and particularly the way that that's attached to sex. You know, that if you're, you know, we live in a society that is shameful, that has shame around sex. I think this is true for all parts of society, not just queer people. But if you, as a young person, you know, come to realize that you somehow experience your relationship to sex differently than what you appear or what you see the people around you to do, it's understandable that that's gonna trigger really deep feelings of shame. And I think we sort of don't talk about shame in the gay community enough generally, you know, that all of this stuff, you could, you know, not to be too sort of psychoanalytically reductive, but I feel like you can reduce a lot of the stuff that we talk about around respectability politics, around identity politics, around this stuff, to an attempt to deal with shame.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. And I think it, encapsulates what I was trying to say quite well. Well done for that. But I 100% agree with you. I think that shame is an integral part of this, and I think that the Born This Way narrative is a clear, a very, very clear expression of that feeling of shame. Yeah, I don't really have much else to add on that. So maybe, you go.
Well, I think it's probably a good point to move on to, you know, something that I'm super fascinated by, which is the other thing, the other sort of question raised by the blog that you mentioned, and something that I think we're both keen to talk about, which is like how, and maybe talking about our own experiences is a good way into this. How do we explain things like camp little kids, you know, like how do we explain those like what appears to be some evidence of queerness that then like before people actually feel like they're like a queer sexuality that then manifests as that later on, like what is that? I mean do you have experiences from your childhood or pre-adolescence that you could identify as like gay experiences, not experiences, but like I guess things feelings that may have indicated that you were gay?
Yeah, I think personally I had probably just prior to puberty, I think I would have started having thoughts about sexuality in that kind of way. I knew at age 5, you know, that wasn't who I was. I guess to answer your question, I think that, look, I think we could go into a huge discussion about the nature versus nurture and what defines, you know, sexuality or what defines any taste that human has, that humans have, or any desires that we have. And there's a huge range of psychological and biological and sociological literature that goes into all of this kind of stuff that suggests that maybe some of it, some people have.
Sure, but I'm kind of, you know, me being me, I'm less interested in that stuff.
We could go into that kind of stuff. Yeah, is what I was trying to get, but I don't think we need to. I think the question I want to know is, what the question I want to ask is, why do we need to actually place, you know, to answer that question? Why does it matter to know why it is that that kid is camp at age 5, or why can't we just say, hey, that kid is camp at age 5, let's just embrace that and enjoy that and accept that and say that's really, really great and move on? Why do we need to find a reason for it? Because I think that the very seeking for the reason and for the very search for a label to put onto that child is the inherent problem that we're talking about, to say, well, okay, that kid is camp because of some biological trait and that makes them gay and that puts them into that box and therefore that is who they are. And that is what was defined when they were age 5, rather than going, hey, that kid is camp, that's awesome. Maybe
totally.
They'll be, you know, and I'm not looking straight for camp, like, or queer camp or whatever.
Like, I'm not looking for labels here, but I suppose, you know, the answer for that of that question to me is, you know, I mean, it was to some degree, it sounded like a rhetorical question. But I mean, to me, the answer is clear, which is just all the stuff we've been talking about the political narratives that reinforces, the shame that addresses, blah, 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 blah. And not just from the queer kids themselves, but from the people around them, you know, from their parents.
Absolutely.
That's what I said. If I think about the reason I'm so interested in it, I guess, is because there does seem to, if I think about my own experience, you know, like I certainly didn't like know I was, you know, gay at 5 years old or whatever either, but when I came out to my mum, her response was basically, oh, I thought maybe you were since you were like a little kid. And I was like, oh, that's weird. And that's certainly something that I think is a common experience. I've certainly had lots of queer friends who've had similar responses from their parents. And if I do kind of think about myself as a little kid, I was very sensitive. I had mostly friends who were girls, you know, absolutely was this little kind of shy sort of, not camp, but definitely, you know, this sensitive little kid. And I am I'm interested in the relationship between that and my sexuality, not as a causal thing. I don't really care about it or think it's possible to make sense of it in that sense. I don't think you know, I... So I suppose that's where I say that I don't care so much about all the scientific literature and that kind of thing. Yep. But I think what I would identify as common to my story and the stories of a lot of people I've heard about their experience as a kid is essentially a sort of a general sense of otherness, you know, that that what we are locating in our own experiences and what we see in the experiences of little kids who we go, you know, that person is quote, like clearly gay or whatever. As much as I have a problem with phrasing it in that way, and I do, what we're identifying is otherness, is that that little kid is different and is expressing and perhaps experiencing themselves as different to the people around them for whatever reason. And I don't really care kind of, you know, why. But, you know, there is, I don't know, that kind of, and I see this reflected across all of my experience around queerness, really, that the otherness and the difference is almost more important than my direct experience of sexuality, than who I want to fuck, than what gets me hard, is the fact that I feel different. That's almost, like, that almost feels more... That makes more sense to me almost than the other way around, than that I feel different because of those things.
Yep, that makes sense.
And I kind of, I'm interested in that, you know, like, I kind of... Because clearly that sort of thing feeds the Born This Way narrative, like feeds, like people do have this inherent experience of difference. And I agree with you in a kind of utopian sense that, like, ideally we shouldn't care and people should just be able to, like, be who they, God,
such a be who they want to so be. Fraught.
Be who you want to be. or just be allowed to sort of exist and that diversity of existence should be fine. But I don't think that's going to be anyone's experience anytime soon.
Yeah, and I agree with you, obviously. And in that sense, you know, to come around to it, you know, starting from that political discussion we were having at the start, you know, I can understand how a Born This Way narrative has been developed to deal with that feeling of otherness, you know, as a way to manage it, or to, and manage is not the right word, but to live with it, basically, you know, to have that feeling of otherness that has existed for as long as you've lived, to really and therefore to feel excluded, or to feel different and to feel outside of the regular world, and a Born This Way narrative is a really, really good way to manage that internally and to manage that externally, to be able to deal with the otherness you have on the inside of you, and to be able to explain that to yourself, and also to be able to explain it to other people of, as you know, this is why I'm like this, it's because of this, it's not because I'm making active choices to be strange.
I would go even further than that and say, and this is maybe a, you know, take this with a grain of salt, because I'm being a little sort of deliberately provocative here, but
fun.
I would say that it's not just the Born This Way that helps us, the Born This Way narrative that helps us explain or deal with our feelings of shame around otherness. It's queer sexuality itself that potentially does that. That, like, you know, I, for example, come to, again, totally take this with a grain of salt, but, you know, I potentially come to identify as gay as a way to make a sort of sense out of my experience of difference.
Oh yeah. Cause it's, you know, it's a easily, and particularly it's an increasingly easily identifiable box that you can put yourself into as a way to explain the thing that you are.
Totally. So you can... And not just culturally, but psychologically.
Mm, yeah. 100%. Yeah. No, I totally agree with you on that. And the importance of those identifiers, the gay, homosexual, lesbian, bisexual, the importance of those boxes is really about that. It's about giving people space, giving people a clear definition for what they are, that they can, that we can then, you know, sit into and be comfortable with, and live with in many ways. And that's, I think that's, I 100% agree with you on that.
I'm tempted to, you know, go even further than that and say, I guess what I'm sort of implying is that it's not just identifying as gay, it's the experience of gay desire that becomes a way to explain those things too. I mean, I know, you know, obviously I have no way to prove this and nothing to back it up, but I feel like it makes as much sense as any sort of narrative, like essential narrative about sexuality.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to have to think about this now.
Yeah, look, I'm being a bit, facetious, I guess, to some degree. But
I think it's...
But it's an interesting place to extend that argument.
And this is what we do well, so, isn't it? We take everything to the... Extend it to the nth degree and see what we can figure out.
we might finish it up there. That's it for us today. Thank you, as always, for listening, and we will be back with another episode in 2 weeks.
In the meantime, as always, you can catch us on queers.podomatic.com or subscribe to us on iTunes. And as always, leave us a review and rating, which will help other people find us.
We also would like people to send us emails, as we said at the top of the show. Please do. It's queerspodcast@gmail.com. Send us whatever you would like. And maybe also let us know in the email if you would be keen for us to read the email out on the podcast. Mm. We're not quite sure, as we said last time, yet how we're going to integrate the emails into the show. But if you're happy for us to do that, we'll have a look and see if we can make that work. You can also find us on Twitter. I'm at Ben C. Riley.
And I'm at Simon Copland. And you can catch me on Facebook at Simon Copland Writer.
Thanks, everyone. And we will see you next time.
Looking forward to it.